night. Please be seated. Justice Karofsky at the end may stay standing. She has some back issues that are better served by remaining.
I heard you just wanted to try to compete with Justice Hagedorn.
I do. I can see the top of his head from here.
I am the tallest member of the court,
it's
yes.
A little more symmetrical this way, I guess.
Not right now.
All right. So we have a group from the Friendship Circle here today, the team advisory group. Nice to see you. Could you stand and we'll just properly say hello? It's nice to have you here. I hope you enjoy your 15 minutes of Supreme Courtness. And I understand you need to leave after that, but you're always welcome to come back here, and we hope that you find it. Have a good day and safe travels, and keep up the good work. All right. The first case this morning, I don't have my case sheet, but that's okay.
Here you go. Take that one.
Okay. Thank you, patience, mm-hmm. Drake Roby. The first case is State v. Richard Arrington, 19 AP 2065. Appearances, please. All right, good morning. The lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, and 5 minutes in rebuttal. That's your understanding? Okay, then. Let's proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. After a six-day jury trial, the jury convicted Richard Arrington of first-degree intentional homicide for the shooting death of Ricardo Gomez, an innocent bystander. It did so after it heard eyewitness testimony from three witnesses to the shooting, and it did so after it heard testimony from witnesses who observed Arrington's conduct before and after the homicide. The jury ultimately rejected Arrington's defense that he shot in self-defense and that a third-party suspect actually shot Gomez. The Court of Appeals vacated the jury conviction in trial. It determined that trial counsel was ineffective when he failed to object to audio recordings that a confidential informant had made between conversations he had with Arrington while they were housed in the county jail. Because the right to counsel had already attached, the Court of Appeals determined that defense counsel should have objected on right to counsel violation. The state is asking that this court reinstate the jury verdict and reverse the Court of Appeals because Arrington fails to meet the Strickland prongs. I would like to begin with prejudice as my brief does, and I want to make it clear right off the bat that the state's position is that the Court of Appeals decision conflicts with and violates Strickland in this respect. Strickland provides that when a court is reviewing the prejudice prong, it is required, it must consider the totality of the evidence that was in front of the jury and the judge. That didn't happen in this case. Nowhere in the Court of Appeals opinion does it recognize that there were three eyewitness homicide, two of them associates of Arrington, and all of them testified, Shorty never had a gun. We never saw Shorty shoot anyone.
Do you concede, counsel, that it is deficient performance to have not objected to the introduction of these statements?
I don't concede that it was deficient performance.
Okay. And so what's your best argument for how it wasn't? Is it State v. Lewis? Is that your best case? I mean, that seems to be what you focus on in your brief.
My argument for deficient performance is that counsel did not have a duty to raise the Sixth Amendment because the law at the time wasn't settled. It, with the facts of this case, whether Miller was an agent was not settled law. You have Lewis and then you have the other cases, and when you're looking at the circumstances as Miller as a confidential informant, whether his actions and the actions with police rise to a state agent is not settled law, and so he did not have a duty to raise the Sixth Amendment claim. I also want to point out, with respect to prejudice, there is nowhere in the Court of Appeals opinion does it recognize or consider the facts that Arrington said to people before the shooting, he intended to get Shorty. There was evidence in the record that he had a motive to kill Shorty, and that is nowhere recognized in the Court of Appeals opinion. And perhaps the most blatant is nowhere in the Court of Appeals opinion is there any evidence at all, any consideration, any recognition of the vast consciousness of guilt that was in front of the jury. And the jury was instructed, you can consider consciousness of guilt when you're looking at the evidence of the crime. Nowhere did it talk about ABT's kidnapping. Nowhere did it talk about Erica Herod's testimony, Eugene's testimony, about what Arrington said to them. So basically, this court needs to, when it is looking at prejudice, do what the Court of Appeals didn't do, and it needs to consider the totality of the evidence.
Counsel, you said for...
Please, Justice Bradley.
Thanks.
No problem.
Counsel, you set forth on pages 25 to 27 some of the testimony that you now aver that the Court of Appeals is missing. And you set forth the testimony of several of the witnesses. Which is the strongest of all of the, you set forth maybe even into 28, but at least 25 to 27?
Sure. I would say ABT's is the most damning testimony to Arrington.
How so?
She had no criminal convictions. She had no motive to make up this story. She was, you know, when you're reading trial transcripts and you're reading 6 days and you get that one witness that it just has spark and it just, that was her testimony. She was believable. She was right in front. She was in the car with Arrington when he reached across and shot Gomez. And she was there and she testified, there were no shots coming back at me. Nobody shot back at us. It was Arrington shooting at Gomez. She said, if someone would have shot back at me, I would have been hit because they were only 30 to 35 feet away. So the court really does need to look at ABT. And she was an associate of Arrington, and so was Devin Landrum, who testified for Arrington. And he testified that there were no shots. He did not see Shorty with a gun. No one saw Shorty with a gun but Arrington. So in order for the court to uphold the Court of Appeals decision, you basically have to agree that everybody was lying but Arrington. There was a vast conspiracy against Arrington that he was the he only shot in self-defense, and Shorty was the one who actually killed Gomez.
So is that a fair description of the testimony? Because there are points, and it may be that AVT did testify that there were no shots going past her, but both AVT and Devin Landrum testified that it looked like Shorty was AVT said it looked like Shorty was reaching for something, and Devin Landrum was clear he was reaching for his waist for something which appeared to be a weapon, and I quoted that. So I get that you want to give us your best argument and the state's best argument, but isn't it possible that if not self-defense, that a jury could have convicted Arrington of a lesser included had they not heard his statement? Isn't that reasonable given that there are some disputes with respect to the testimony?
There is no disputes with the testimony that no one saw Shorty with a gun. That is undisputed. So whatever discrepancies there are in the testimony that Arrington tries to show out, everyone is consistent that Shorty did not have a gun.
Well, okay, and so you just dismiss outright the testimony about them believing that he was reaching for a gun and the fact that Shorty wasn't there, and so the fact that no guns were found don't say whether or not Shorty could have left with a gun. I mean, you want us to totally eliminate all of that when we look at the totality.
No, I mean, I agree that ABT testified and Landrum testified that it looked like he was reaching for a gun. And after that, they both testified that, Arrington just started shooting. And they both testified consistently that even though it looked like Shorty was reaching for a gun, they never saw a gun.
Right, so if we're not talking about self-defense and we're talking about second degree or other lesser, which I know second degree was a lesser included, if we find deficient performance, aren't the statements prejudicial to the point where a different verdict could have been reached under second degree? I mean, I get self-defense, I think, is a tough one, but second degree homicide.
Well, the jury was instructed that they could consider those two, and the jury heard the evidence, and the jury didn't believe Arrington.
Well, the jury didn't believe Arrington after they heard the testimony, not just his testimony, but these recordings. I mean, pretty damning statements in these recordings, wouldn't you say? And the testimony of Miller about the recordings.
I would agree that the recordings did not help Arrington at all. But I don't think that they were the nail in the coffin. The nail in the coffin was the three eyewitness testimony to this homicide, and they were consistent on that. And so while I agree that the recordings and Miller's testimony, you know, aided the state's case, the state didn't need it. There's just not a reasonable probability that had those recordings, had Miller's testimony not been admitted, that he would have been acquitted.
Does it have to be that he's acquitted? I'm sorry, and then I'm done. Does it have to be that he'd be acquitted? It just has to be a reasonable probability of a different outcome, which here could have been second degree, right?
It could have been, and again, the jury was free to believe Arrington that he had a reasonable probability that he was just aiming, he was trying to save, you know, Arrington testified that he was trying to save AVT and he was trying to save Devin Landrum, and that it was reasonable for him to fire those shots, and they just didn't believe him. And so I think when you look at the totality of the evidence, again, which the Court of Appeals simply did not do, when you look at the totality of the evidence against him, there's just not a reasonable probability that had the jury not heard the recordings in Miller's testimony, that they would have found him not guilty, or that they would have found him guilty of a lesser offense.
Attorney Schaefer, can I ask you about Mr. Miller's testimony? And I'm looking at the arguments that you made in your brief where you said that Mr. Arrington failed to prove prejudice, and you've talked about this. Now, several witnesses saw Mr. Arrington shoot the gun. He told witnesses that he killed the victim. Miller was impeached with 18 priors. The defense attorney was able to argue that the recordings were muddled and garbage. You describe the statement that he made about dumping down on the crib. And then in your argument you say, even if the recordings had not been admitted, Miller could have testified to their content.
Right. I'm incorrect on that.
Okay.
I'm incorrect about it. He did, actually, post-conviction counsel did move to not only have basically her argument was like, had it not only been the recordings but Miller's testimony, that, you know, basically that there was prejudice. So I am wrong on that argument. Had the recordings been not allowed, Miller's testimony would not have been allowed as well. So
thank you.
Yep. In addition to the testimony against Arrington, there was also no prejudice because he was just an incredible witness. You had all these witnesses, including his friends, testify about his behavior. We'll do the after the homicide. You had Eugene Herod testify that after the homicide, Arrington came to her house, washed with bleach, and said, "Don't say nothing." Her brother came to her house, smelled the bleach, and then later that night, Arrington calls Eugene and says, "I just fanned Shorty down." Nowhere in that is in the Court of Appeals. The next day, Arrington finds out he didn't kill Shorty. He accidentally killed Gomez, and he says, "I'm going to go get that explicative Shorty." None of that is in the Court of Appeals' opinion, and it was the totality of the evidence that the Court of Appeals was required to consider. And you also have ABT's testimony, and nowhere in the Court of Appeals' opinion does it discuss the kidnapping and how he came to Milwaukee to find her, and he also how he threatened to kill her or her family if she said anything. And in regards to Arrington's conduct before the homicide, you have evidence from James Allen, who testified that after Shorty had cut Arrington's face, he told James Allen that he was going to mess up Shorty. And same thing with Christopher Howard. Days before the homicide, he's talking to Christopher Howard. He's upset that Arrington has cut his face, and he said he's going to go handle his business. So you have all this testimony from before the homicide, eyewitness to the homicide, and the consciousness of guilt after the homicide. I just don't see how the tapes and Miller's testimony, had they not been played, that Arrington would have been convicted.
Counsel, advise me how your argument advances or develops the law as opposed to error correcting. So give me the law you want to be developed out of this case.
What I would like this court to say is that when courts are looking at the prejudice prong, you have to follow Strickland. It's not just error correction here, because the Court of Appeals misapplied and violated Strickland when it failed to even recognize or consider all of the evidence against Arrington. All of the evidence unaffected by the error, unaffected by the alleged error of the tapes and of Miller's testimony.
Well, it seems unremarkable to me to have an advancement in the law that says you have to follow Strickland.
I mean, that's right. It's the law, right?
Right.
So I'm looking for the advancement of the law as opposed to error correcting.
I'm sorry?
I'm asking why this advances the law, or how it advances the law. I want to advance the law. So how does it advance the law rather than merely correct the error of the Court of Appeals because they didn't appropriately follow, in your words, well-established rule of Strickland, deficient performance and prejudice?
Sure, I think more than I wouldn't say advancing the law, it clarifies the law. It clarifies the law that, you know, that this is what courts, when they analyze prejudice, are supposed to do. And because when you petition for review, like, was there a violation of the U.S. Supreme Court law? Yeah, there was. There was a violation. The court was required to do this. Must is the word. You must consider the totality of the evidence that the judge and jury had. And they didn't recognize it. They didn't consider it.
Counsel, can you talk about the deficient performance prong?
Sure. Okay. So the deficient performance prong, the state's argument is that counsel did not have a duty to raise a Sixth Amendment claim because of the facts of the case it had, because of Miller's position. The law was not settled as to whether Miller was an agent of the state. And so because the law wasn't settled, there was no duty to advance a Sixth Amendment violation claim. And I think the best evidence that the state has for this argument is the procedural posture of this case. The trial court in this case wrote a very lengthy and very thorough decision, making numerous findings which have never been contested, and it applied the law, the four cases, the U.S. Supreme Court cases in Lewis. And it determined that there was no state agency here. The Court of Appeals took the same findings of fact, didn't find any of them clearly erroneous, applied the same law and said, yeah, there is a state agency here, so you should have objected on Sixth Amendment grounds. And I'm not saying that any time a trial court, you know, disagrees with the Court of Appeals or vice versa, that somehow is a novel or unsettled issue. But in this case, they are all talking about the same facts and they're all talking about the same law, and they came to polar opposites.
Counsel, you're not making a vigorous defense of the trial court's decision. You can win multiple ways. You can win on prejudice. You could win on no deficient performance, because even if the Court of Appeals was right on that question, that maybe it wasn't something that any reasonably competent lawyer would raise. But you can also win because the trial court was correct on this. You're not making a vigorous defense.
Right. Well, I would request that this court write it is, Strickland also provides that when it's easier to dispose of a Strickland claim on prejudice as opposed to deficient performance, that the court should do that. And I think that even if there is a violation, even if the court does find a deficient performance, that means the overwhelming evidence that against Arrington that he just can't show
sure.
prejudice.
Fair enough. Are you just not, you're not interested in defending the trial court's decision at all? I understand. But
I mean, I led with prejudice because it's the money argument to me. I mean, I do think that is my best argument. I do think I can make the argument with deficient performance, especially when we have the trial court and you have the, I mean, so like, I clerked for a judge who said, well, can you make that argument with a straight face? I can make that argument with a straight face, but with a straight face, I do know that prejudice is my best argument and that I would like this court to, you know, to determine on narrow grounds is what the court does. And if the court, I would encourage this court just to, you know, you can consider it on prejudice and you don't have to.
So you don't, do you want, let me try one more time. Are you interested in making any defense of the fact that the trial court may have been correct on the agency question?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Persistent.
That's right. Yeah, okay, so yes, I do think that the trial court was correct on the agency issue. Okay, so when the trial court is that they made so many findings about the relationship between the informant and the police, and basically the trial court made these findings that there was no consideration promised and that there was no direct control of the informant. And what the trial court did is it looked at the most recent case, it looked at the Wisconsin case, Lewis, and it said these are the factors that the court needs to consider. And because there was no prior formal agreement and because, you know, the police in this case did not tell Miller any questions to ask, what to say, or anything. There just was no control. There was no involvement in the questioning of Arrington. And so I think the trial court was correct, you know, when it applied Lewis that.
Was it even law enforcement's idea?
No.
Okay. So, how did it come about that he might think that he would want to offer information?
So Miller's attorney contacted the DA's office, and he told them that his client wanted to basically Miller told the police and told his attorney that he doesn't know why, but Arrington is talking about his case, and do you think I should record him? And the police said yes. So Miller approached the police and said, Arrington is talking, should I record him? And it was Miller's idea, yes, should I record him? And the police said, yeah, you can record him.
What do you make of the fact that he was told that the information he gathered would be part of his consideration and that the police are the ones that put a recording device on him? And don't those two factors distinguish this case from Lewis?
I think that statement from the Court of Appeals is taken out of context. I think that Wanta and Linsmeyer were clear that there was no consideration specifics given, that they did not.
Did they ever give specifics? Where have you seen them tell them exactly what they're going to give? Don't they say you will be given consideration depending on what you give us? That's a typical arrangement, right?
There was consideration given in his testimony with Powell and blanking on the second defendant. And so we have that, but there just, and so there was specific consideration given, but there just wasn't in this.
But they didn't
case.
Know what they were going to get, right? What if he came back with nothing? Doesn't it depend on what they given?
It does, and it depends on if there's an agency relationship. And the Lewis uses the terms, was there a meeting of the minds? Was there a talk-down agreement? Was there a benefit? Was there a quid pro quo? And there wasn't in this case. And that is a requirement that Lewis has, is that there has to be some prior formal agreement. And there just simply wasn't in this case.
I understand that you think prejudice is your stronger argument in relation to Strickland, but as it goes to deficient performance, how would you suggest we look at the fact that the defense attorney at the Mochner hearing said, yeah, I missed this one?
I struggle with that. I mean, I tried to I didn't whitewash that in my brief. He said I didn't consider it. I didn't research it. But despite that, what Arrington has to prove is that the law was settled. So even if he had researched the issue, despite that, under deficient performance, Arrington has to prove that the law in this case, that Miller was an agent, and he still doesn't prove that the law in this case was settled.
And there's really two prongs to the test under Lewis, right? The prior formal agreement is just one aspect of it. So even if this court were to construe the deal that Arrington made as satisfying that prong, there also has to be proof that the police directed or controlled or involved themselves in the questioning.
Correct.
Is there anything in the record to suggest that the police directed the questioning, controlled the questioning, or were involved in the questioning?
No, and there is evidence that they were not. Their testimony was consistent. They did not tell them what to say, what to ask. They did not involve themselves at all in the questioning.
They gave them the recording equipment, and that was it, right?
That was it. Correct. So, yeah, both prongs of Lewis were not met in this case. There was no prior formal agreement, and there was direct control or involvement in the questioning.
Counsel, I'm finished. Isn't it also true on the deficient performance ground that the standard is not whether an attorney made a mistake or missed something? Isn't the standard whether basically any reasonably competent attorney would not have made that mistake, which is a different kind of question? The performance has to not just be bad. It has to be so bad that you can't even be described as having counsel. That's the way the U.S. Supreme Court has described it. So even if an attorney arguably should have raised an issue, that doesn't make it deficient performance if an attorney didn't raise an issue, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, yeah. And I think, and that's what we have in this case, is even if he...
You may finish.
Okay. So even if he did miss the issue, there's still... Even if he did miss the issue, which he conceded that he did, it still wasn't deficient performance because the law wasn't clear on state agency, and so he did not have. Thank you.
My name is Suzanne Hagopian, and I represent Mr. Arrington. In listening to the state's argument, I have two primary thoughts. One is, boy, the state doesn't want to talk about what the state did in order to obtain Mr. Arrington's statements, that how they used the jail informant, provided him with a recording device, authorized him to secretly record conversations with an individual whose right to counsel had attached, and then to use those unlawfully obtained statements at trial. I guess I understand maybe why they don't want to talk about it, but I kind of assume that's why the case is here. The second
Let me just ask you on that point. What's your best authority for the proposition that any time the state provides recording equipment, that person is an agent of the state? Because that's really what we have, right?
Well, we have... The providing of the recording equipment is such powerful evidence in terms of law enforcement's involvement in the informant's questioning. What the Sixth Amendment right to counsel prohibits is, and this is directly from the last case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Cullman, is it says that the defendant has shown a violation of the right to counsel if the police and informant took some action beyond mere listening that was designed deliberately to elicit incriminating statements.
Okay, but back to my question, which is every time, I'll try to say it a different way, every time law enforcement gives someone a recording device, that in and of itself makes the person an agent of law enforcement?
It really solidifies it.
Well, is
I can't find another case in which the police in the setting of a jail have given a jail informant a recording device, have authorized the informant to use the recording device to memorialize conversations with that defendant about his case. Because no case exists because that is such an egregious violation.
In your view, it's a bright line rule. If police provide a recording device, the person is an agent.
I don't think we need a bright line rule, and I don't think it's appropriate. In Sixth Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment cases, generally don't. The question is, did the police take some action beyond mere listening? And I think Lewis, the test there is on the right track, that it requires some prior formal agreement between law enforcement and the individual. It requires some direction and control. But we also...
So counsel, would, if the recording device were not used and Miller testified at trial about what he heard, you wouldn't be here, right?
Oh, I would be here.
You would be here.
Absolutely. Because the agency relation occurred once the police and Miller sat down together, devised a plan about who he would talk to.
No, he came saying that
he approached,
you know, Mr. Harrington was talking about his case and asked, did they want him to listen? And of course he did. But he listened with the aid of a recorder. And I guess my question to you is, let's get rid of the recorder. Say he just listened to what he heard in the jailhouse. I don't know what theory would preclude Miller from testifying.
Because the U.S. Supreme Court in Moulton made clear that it doesn't matter whether it is a citizen, an individual, an informant, a co-defendant who approaches the police and offers up their assistance, because that's what happened in Moulton.
I thought in Moulton, didn't they record the phone conversation?
They did. But in terms of establishing the agency relationship, we have a question here by two justices about, well, we don't have an agency relationship when the individual approaches the police. That's not correct, because that's what happened in Moulton, and it didn't matter. In fact, what they said was, that is every bit of as much a violation of the Sixth Amendment right, because it's a knowing exploitation of the opportunity to confront an accused without their counsel.
Isn't the distinction in Lewis that Gray went to the police after he had already gotten the statement? So here, if Miller listened, got statements from Arrington, and then went to the police with those statements, you wouldn't be here.
That's right.
So the difference is that he approached them ahead of time. They said, okay, yes, let's do that, and they wired him up and sent him in.
Right, because that is completely reasonable that it matters that there has to be some prior agreement, some prior understanding. The Sixth Amendment doesn't provide a protection about some lone wolf operating in the institution who, without any discussion with law informant, is talking to other inmates, obtaining information about their cases, because that individual isn't an agent of the state. When they're doing that, they're just doing it out of some hope, some desire to maybe get something out of it.
And here, if Miller had gone to the police and said, I want to talk to Arrington, they said, do whatever you want, and just send him back in, that would probably be okay, too.
Yes. Yes. It really is critical that there be a understanding between law enforcement and the individual before the conversations, the information is obtained.
So there needs to be a quid pro quo, right?
No.
Well, doesn't there have to be some consideration? That is, doesn't the way I'm understanding Lewis, and I think Justice Rebecca Bradley was asking Attorney Schaefer about this, that there has to be that consideration as well, right? I mean, there has to be the There doesn't have to be any consideration.
There does not have to be consideration. And let me give you an example why. You can have an agency relationship without promise of any sort of payment involved. Listen to this example. We have a legislator who is charged with misconduct in public office. They've been charged, represented by counsel. A private citizen comes to law enforcement and says, I'm acquainted with this defendant, this legislator. He's talking about his case. I think I can get some information. And they say, great. Here's what we'd like you to do. Sit down with this legislator. Let's say there's a recording device or not. But there's this prior agreement that this individual is going to meet with the legislator, and they've designed this with law enforcement. They engage in conversation with that legislator, and they report back to the police on what they obtained. That's a violation of the Sixth Amendment because we have an informant and the police taking some action beyond merely listening that is designed to elicit incriminating statements. There's no consideration discussed or given, and there doesn't have to be. We don't know what is the motive of that private citizen. It might be they actually think justice should be done. It might be that they're hoping to gain that legislator's seat. In either case, it doesn't matter because we have a prior formal agreement and we have direction, control in the extent you don't need much, but they have authorized this individual to talk to the defendant.
How is that direction or control over the questioning? In this case, under these facts, as I understand them, the police, after hearing from, I think, Miller's attorney, maybe through the DA, gave him recording equipment. They didn't tell him what to say. They didn't give him any questions to ask. They weren't listening in. I don't see any control, direction, or involvement over the questioning of the defendant in this case.
The direction came at the point in their discussion about what the informant would do for the state. And the informant says, Arrington is talking about his case. Should I record my conversations with him? And they say, yes, you should. That is some direction because now they have directed him to record conversations with Arrington.
But they didn't tell him what to say. They didn't give him any questions. And when I was reading what Miller actually asked him, he never asked questions about the case. It was they started talking about other things, and then Arrington volunteered a lot of information. So I'm not sure we even have the informant eliciting incriminating remarks, much less law enforcement.
Well, we have the informant who's saying Arrington's talking about his case. They know exactly what that means. That's a homicide case on which he's been charged, and they know that in particular because one of the detectives involved in devising the scheme is the lead detective on Arrington's homicide case. They didn't have to say, we want you to ask X, Y, and Z. They all knew what they were looking for, and I would hope that this court would not sanction behavior by law enforcement that is essentially a wink and a nod. We know what we want. We're just not going to say the words.
I wouldn't sanction a wink and a nod, but again, I go back to what I've read in this record, and it reads like Arrington was just talking, and because he was talking, Miller said, you want me to record this? It wasn't Miller eliciting the information or the police, and I think that's what's required under Coleman.
I would ask the court to take a look at United States versus Henry. That's a jail informant case as well. That's a case where the police specifically told their informant, don't ask any questions, just listen. The informant did something. You know what he did? He did enough to stimulate conversation. That was sufficient to amount to a Sixth Amendment violation.
Do you quarrel with any of the facts found by the trial court?
For the most part, the facts, I can't say, are clearly erroneous. The court's error was in the application of those facts to the legal standard.
And in these facts, unlike Moulton, in Moulton the police asked, will you wear this device? Will you record? It was the police, their idea for the informant to proceed with a recording device. Here, it was Mr. Miller's request for a recording device. Does that have any importance in your mind?
I would view that exactly the same way as Moulton. It doesn't matter who suggests doing what. Once the police join in the plan, whether it's suggested by the individual, they are a full part of that plan. And, of course, the recording device, this is why the recording device makes this case so easy, because Miller could not have carried out the plan. What they were looking for was a way to memorialize those conversations, and Miller could not have carried that out without the government supplying him 3 days in a row with a recording device secreted around his waist that he could use to make a record of those conversations.
Counsel, isn't it? I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Chief.
Just a brief follow. So anytime, I think the test, your test that you'd like us to adopt is the only time someone is not an agent is if they come to the police with the conversation already.
That is, I'm hesitating on your only time because that.
Well, what else would, if someone comes to the police first, and it's almost to be careful what you wish for because people like to get consideration for assisting law enforcement and generally want to shore that up before they do anything to assist. If your proposition is that what in this case, let's just stick to the facts here. If Miller would have somehow recorded the conversation or somehow told the police about the conversation, he should have done that and then brought that to the police, and then he wouldn't be an agent.
If there had been no prior understanding that he would be doing this, yes, then we can't say that it was an agency.
So under that group of facts, what is the cooperating person's leverage? I mean, law enforcement could just call them as a witness.
That's why we don't really know necessarily what an individual's motives are.
Most people want consideration in this position. Well, they're in jail. They have a statement. They want something
for sure. I will agree that
they're
most
hoping they can get that.
Most typically, these cases involve either co-defendants or criminals who are trying to gain something. But it doesn't have to be limited to that.
Well, how is someone not an agent? If they come to law enforcement and they ask, you know, they say, hey, I'm talking to this guy, that if law enforcement says, yeah, let us know what you hear, or assists in any way, or says somehow you might get something for this, it seems like under your test, they become an agent right away.
And how they wouldn't be an agent if law enforcement said, no, we don't want to be a part of that because that individual is represented by counsel. They are protected by the Sixth Amendment.
Yeah, that's a tough standard because then no one's ever going to be able to negotiate getting any credit for helping law enforcement. And law enforcement has to say, no, no, don't tell us what you learn.
I don't think that it is in any way an impossible standard. What we see in some of these cases is that people are often willing to talk and unwise to talk because there's two parts of this in order to get a Sixth Amendment violation. It's not just enough to have agency. There has to be something that looks like interrogation.
So if an agency relationship is established, and this is the Coleman situation, where you have a prior understanding between a jail informant and law enforcement, and the law enforcement places this informant in very close proximity. I believe he was a cellmate of the person they're interested in. They tell him, just keep your ears open. And that individual obeyed that instruction. We have an agency relationship, but we don't have a Sixth Amendment violation because there is no interrogation, nothing that looks like interrogation, nothing even amounting to stimulating conversation.
Counsel, anyone else? You spent a lot of time on the legal issue here, and well spent time. I want to just take a little of your time to go to the prejudice, the Strickland standard. When I read the state's brief, I thought, wow, there is a lot of evidence, right? And, of course, the Court of Appeals didn't mention a lot of this. So what's your best argument on the prejudice issue?
Sure. I guess I would begin by saying that the state today is using the phrase totality of the evidence. I think that's really a bit of code for what they're saying is sufficiency of the evidence. But the prejudice review under the Strickland standard is not a review of the sufficiency of the evidence. This court has reminded the bench and bar of that not long ago in Scholar, where it specifically said the Strickland prejudice is not a review of the sufficiency of the evidence. So I think I started by saying I had two thoughts after hearing this. The second one is, and I mean this very genuinely, that perhaps the court would want to consider whether the state's petition was improvidently granted, because I don't see how any new law is being developed in this case, where the state has really all but conceded the question of deficient performance. And what they're asking this court to do really is to examine the sufficiency. I would like to say a couple things, though.
Let me just ask you about that. We have it's recommended for publication. So do you think this case being published will clarify the proper analysis on Strickland?
I don't think that more guidance is needed. I think Scholar made it clear it's not a review of the sufficiency of the evidence. The Court of Appeals quoted Scholar, and it went on to state and apply the standard under Strickland, where the question is not whether the jury would have found the defendant innocent, but the question is whether there's a reasonable probability that the jury would have acquitted the defendant. And I believe, Justice Dallet, you correctly pointed out that in this case, it's really not a reasonable probability of an all-out acquittal, but whether the jury, reasonable probability the jury could have found him guilty of a lesser form of homicide. And, you know, the state, having run through some of the evidence at trial, I would like to point out that I think it's fair to look at the evidence at trial, but what the state doesn't really want to talk about is how the state used the statements that it obtained through its work with the informant, how it used that at trial. And that has to be part of the prejudice analysis, because we're asking, is there a reasonable probability of a different result if the jury hadn't heard the very damning evidence that it had obtained unlawfully? And as I had argued in the brief, you know, their informant was the state's final and unimpeachable witness. Because there were the recordings, the defense had nothing it could do to call into question his testimony. It shredded Mr. Arrington's credibility because it directly contradicted his version of what occurred during that shooting. And the state highlighted it in closing argument, indeed even gushed over the fact of how fortunate the state was that it had those recordings, because the defense couldn't do what it usually does, which is try to challenge and poke holes in the credibility of the state's witnesses.
What's your best argument on the reasonable probability of a different result? Which different result?
Sure.
Is your strongest argument
is that there would have been reasonable doubt that it was first-degree intentional homicide, but a lesser form, because there were holes in the state's case. 42 witnesses, but only four witnessed the shooting. Three testified that they saw Shorty reaching for something. One of those said he thought he was reaching for a gun. Plus, the state had a missing witness who would have been the fifth person who witnessed that shooting. That witness was Shorty. And Shorty was nowhere to be seen. One of the state's witnesses testified that after the shooting, he was sneaking off, like he didn't want anyone to talk to him. There was no evidence that police had ever searched Shorty and his girlfriend, so we don't know if Shorty had a weapon on him. The jury would have known, though, that Shorty had a penchant for carrying firearms and for using them. He was a violent man. There was all of that provided support for Mr. Arrington's testimony that Shorty fired a shot, grabbed a gun, shot, and it was his bullet that shot Mr. Gomez. In addition, other evidence supporting Mr. Arrington's testimony at trial.
If the jury believed that Shorty shot Mr. Gomez, then that would be an acquittal. I thought you said your best. So my question to you is, you're arguing that the standard is a reasonable probability of a different result if the jury hadn't heard the recordings, right? And then my understanding of your argument is a different result could be an acquittal and perfect self-defense or a lesser degree of homicide, right? Second-degree intentional homicide, right? But if you're saying that if the jury believed that Shorty killed Gomez, that wouldn't be second-degree intentional homicide. That would have led to an acquittal. So my question is, if your best argument is that the different result is second-degree intentional homicide, how does that play out here?
Well,
how is that your best argument?
What we need as the defense attorneys, right, is to have reasonable doubt, right? And so reasonable doubt that this was not first-degree intentional homicide, but that Mr. Arrington fired because he saw Shorty with a gun. Now, the jury might have reasonable doubt about that, and then they would go to one of the other options. Mr. Arrington's testimony was also that when he fired three shots, and he fired them all to he described it as the feet level of the house, to where the people were standing, because he didn't really want to hurt anyone. The physical evidence corroborated that, because there were three spent shell casings found. There were three places at the house where it appeared that there were bullets that had damaged it. All of those were below the entryway.
Counsel, how do you get to a lesser degree of homicide without any proof that Shorty had a gun?
Well, I don't agree with the statement that proof that Shorty had a gun. We have witnesses who said it looked like he was reaching for something. We have Mr. Arrington's testimony that he saw Shorty with a gun and fire a gun. So there was evidence supporting the notion that Shorty had a gun and he used it.
And there wasn't any testimony that Shorty used his gun, because the woman who was sitting in the window right by the car, no shots came at her, and there was no evidence of any shots striking the car or anything around
well,
the car.
Well, Mr. Arrington provided evidence through his testimony.
Well, okay.
Okay, even if the gun wasn't fired, though, doesn't I'm looking at these elements of second-degree intentional homicide, and there has to be intent to kill, and then the state, I just lost where they were. The state then has to disprove using force beyond unnecessary force is what. Yeah, I know. This is very slow.
When we're talking about second-degree imperfect
self-defense,
that's when you get into the reasonableness of the belief.
Right, but it wouldn't even have to be that Shorty fired his weapon, right?
Right.
It could just be that under these mitigating circumstances that death was caused because the actor believed he was in imminent danger of great bodily harm.
The jury could conclude that it was not, that it was what they'd be asked, let's say under second degree, is whether there was a reasonable belief that the need for force was imminent and that the degree of force was reasonable. But in addition to the second degree, there was also first and second degree reckless homicide that was before the jury.
And that's for firing at their feet, if a jury believed that.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
What was the defense here?
Pardon?
What was the defense?
The defense was primarily one of self-defense, that he acted in self-defense because he saw Shorty reaching for a gun. He saw Shorty fire the gun. That's the Court of Appeals was correct that the statements that the law enforcement had obtained through use of the informant really eliminated that defense because in multiple ways. Because in the conversations, which did include specific questions by Miller to Mr. Arrington, they were able to show that he wasn't afraid of Shorty. He was laughing about him, making fun of him. That when he was sitting out in front of the house and saw Shorty, that he got angry, not afraid. It added fuel to the fire. And what did he do? He dumped the crib down, which the informant translated for the jury meant he just kept shooting out the house. And the reason he did that is he was acting in retaliation because he and Shorty had an ongoing feud. That's how the state was able to portray what happened. That was highly prejudicial. Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I don't have much just to follow up on her last point, that the state was able to prove what happened in this case by the eyewitness testimony. And no eyewitness, there was no evidence that Shorty had a gun that day. There's absolutely no evidence in the record. So the state was able to prove this case because of the damning eyewitness testimony, two of them Arrington's associates, who said there was no gun at Shorty. Shorty didn't shoot at anyone. There was also the testimony, again, from the individuals that observed Arrington's behavior before the homicide, where Shorty made statements that proved he had a motive. I'm sorry, where Arrington made statements showing that he had a motive to kill Shorty. And then the state proved this case, again, through the consciousness of guilt, all of Arrington's statements after the homicide, where he goes and washes bleach. He finds out he shot the wrong person. He says, I'm going to go back and finish the job. So any holes in the state's case, I mean, none that are important, none that are the eyewitness testimony that said Shorty did not have a gun.
Counsel, I wanted to ask about something I've seen In briefs lately, I think I see it sometimes in Court of Appeals opinions, and you reference it here, is when you think about the deficient performance prong, you see these arguments about is it settled or not settled. And I'm not sure if that's the right question to ask under Strickland. It certainly seems that there's a degree of settledness there, that you see that language in cases, and that makes sense. But it seems to me that an issue could still be debatable, but that a reasonably competent counsel would raise it, and an issue could be, that there are times when an issue might not be completely settled in the law, where the legal question that I think the Supreme Court has said we need to ask here is, would a reasonably competent counsel have failed to take an action or raise an issue or that sort of thing, which strikes me as just a little bit different question than whether an issue is settled or not settled. And I just want to make sure we're being sort of precise in our language on that.
Sure. And the state took its language from like Breitzman and Limburger, basically, where they said.
Right. And I think that case does use the word generally. Right, that's an important issue because I don't want to short circuit a good deficient performance analysis here with is it settled or not settled, because that's not the legal question, is whether this is a failure that no reasonably competent counsel, acting reasonably would make under the circumstances, which again is a slightly different kind of question. So again, I can think of lots of situations where you might say, any reasonably competent counsel is going to raise an issue, even if it's not one where there's a clearly final answer that's been announced by court. But a counsel maybe should still raise it.
But counsel might what?
Maybe counsel should still raise it. And it would be failure for them not to in a given situation.
I mean, I agree with that. And, and counsel in this case, he didn't raise it. And like he said, he missed it. And I guess, the state's point was that, even if he had caught it, that, there was no duty because, again, quoting Breitzman and Limburger, that the law was settled with respect to Miller if he was a government agent.
Or perhaps a reasonably competent counsel would look at the situation and conclude the person wasn't acting as an agent and therefore decided not to raise it, even if he didn't, even if he was wrong, even if he thinks, shoot, I should have raised that issue, that doesn't make it deficient performance, right?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Attorney Schaefer, I want to ask you, I think probably one last question about the reasonable probability of a different result, and I just want you to respond to, I think tone is important in a trial when people testify, right, and here the defendant testified. And it seems from reading the briefs and looking at the transcript that he testified quite well.
Correct.
And that there was quite a distinction between how he testified on the stand and what the jury heard in those recordings.
Correct.
How do you suggest we analyze that?
I would suggest we analyze that by looking at the evidence that came in that talked about how Arrington really spoke. And you have ABT saying that he called me a bitch and that he said he was going to ice me. You have, James Allen saying he was going to F up Shorty. And you have Eugene saying he uses the N-word and he's going to take care of that. So I think the jury knew Arrington was just performing. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, this concludes the first oral argument for this morning. The court will recess and reconvene when counsel are prepared and seated for the second.